to achieve a higher rate of return than the market unless, and this is a life-changing unless you are willing to learn to invest like Buffett and Munger. But that's a full-time job, I protested. I would be doing it part-time, so I can't put in the research that you can. And I don't even have any time to put toward it at all. I'm barely treading water as it is. I know shooting for a 26% compounded rate of return per year is an incredibly high goal. But what if you could take the shot with less risk than putting money in an index? If you put a bit of time into it now, the rewards will be huge in the future. If you don't, you'll be, I know, I interrupted, working at Walmart till I die. Present Danielle and future Danielle were fighting in my head. I didn't have the time, but I couldn't afford not to make the time, not with the potential to get to a whole new life in just a few years. I don't want that for you, obviously. This is the single most useful and protective thing I can teach you. What's stopping you? He had opened the door away from a yes or no answer. His first mistake. All my fears came flooding back, and I jumped all over it. How about the fact that the macroeconomic world affects the stock market in ways I can't possibly predict or imagine? How about the fact that in 2008, I had no comprehension or clue that there were real estate securities that were going to bring down our economy? How about a world war? How about companies that lie to the regulators? How about not knowing enough about an industry to know if a certain company in that industry is a good investment, or if the whole industry is going down? He had knocked down my practical objections, and now my deeper worries were coming out in full force. There are so many things to know, and I know you have some certainty about your investments, but I don't know how you get there. I mean, really, the question is, how do I know when I know enough? Dad knew I was worrying about getting good information. Okay, now that is a good question. You will know because I will teach you. I wasn't sure I would know. Companies are made up of people. People make mistakes. People act emotionally, and they have things happening in their lives other than their jobs. And they have incentives to lie and pass the buck to the next guy. And they want to do the right thing, but don't. Sometimes people steal and cover it up. The view of a company as a monolithic entity that cannot be shaken is dead wrong. I had to be able to tell from my research if a monolith was quavering. I first want to show you how choosing wonderful companies works on a broad level, Dad interrupted. Then we'll dive into the details of choosing particular companies and how to get good information. The secret to good investing is to wait. I won't let you do anything before you're ready and the market is ready. That makes me think of the four levels of mastery you talk about. Yes, exactly, Dad exclaimed. My dad often mentions an old saying about the four levels of mastery of a skill, and it has stuck with me. The first level is unconscious incompetence, when you're completely incompetent at that skill. And don't even worry about it, because you don't know anything about it. I'm unconsciously incompetent at yacht racing, now that I think about it. The second level is conscious incompetence, when you know what you need to know, but you can't do it very well. I'm consciously incompetent at singing karaoke, and I'm not trying to get better at it. I'd rather curl up in the corner of the booth, drink old fashions, cheer my friends on, and dance when a Britney song comes on. That's what I call not a bad night. For a skill I do want to be competent at, though, being consciously incompetent feels excruciatingly painful. The third level of mastery is conscious competence. That's when you know what you need to know, and if you stay focused and conscious about what you're doing, you can do it well. The good news about conscious competence is that when you get there, you become even better quickly. The brutal days of conscious incompetence are gone, and better days are ahead. The fourth level of mastery, unconscious competence, is the experience of doing something well without thinking about it. Athletes often call the extreme experience of unconscious competence the zone, a state of activity that is experienced as a kind of mindless witnessing of, say, the ball effortlessly going through the hoop. Warren Buffett says he can decide in minutes if he wants to buy an entire company. I imagine he is in that state of unconscious competence. Me, I'd happily settle for conscious competence. You are going to become consciously competent faster than you can imagine, Dad promised me. My dad was so nice to offer to spend his time teaching me. He's a busy guy, and I didn't take his offer lightly. I wasn't completely confident that he would see it through the whole year, but he seemed to want to show up, and there was nothing I could do but see what happened. Future Danielle needed this, that I knew. Maybe, I thought, present Danielle would get something out of it too. I spent my days taking care of projects and tasks and questions for other people. This investing practice was something I could do for me, and me alone. And maybe I'd get to know my dad a bit better, or differently, anyway. One concern remained, though. There's a reason I went to law school instead of business school. Numbers swim around in my brain until they float out of my ears, never to be seen again. To me, accounting statements look like impenetrable columns of tiny black numbers. I can feel them physically hurting my mind as each minute ticks by like electrolysis on my brain. I know I'm not the only one to whom accounting is intimidating, and for good reason. The Enron accounting scandal proved that financial accounting can be a mysterious art, even to those who are certified professional accountants. You know I'm terrible at math, right? Financial statements are not something I enjoy. Sheepishly, he said, I gauge whether my investing students will be able to follow something by trying it out on you. I know that if you can understand it, they can. I laughed. Good, so we're on the same page then. Am I teachable? Of course you are. I will teach you how to value a company. We're not trying to jump over 6-foot hurdles, as Buffett says. We're only taking on 6-inch hurdles. You'll be fine. Don't worry. Am I going to have to buy stock soon? I don't really want to. No! You're not even allowed to buy stock. How about that? You're probably going to get impatient and want to buy stock before you're ready. I gave him a major side eye on that one, which he couldn't see, but he seemed to feel it anyway. You should not expect to buy a single company until this year is over, he went on. You've got to get centered in the knowledge first. Established in being, perform action, he quoted from the Bhagavad Gita. I knew what he meant. Along with transcendental meditation and yoga, I had grown up reading Vedic texts in both English and the original Sanskrit. Exchanging a quote in a 5,000-year-old dead language from the Bhagavad Gita was perfectly normal for us. My parents were weirdos who somehow became successful. What can I say? Dad meant that my investing knowledge had to be established within me so that my instincts would be true, which was perfect because I dreaded putting real money in the market. Don't worry, Dad. I don't think I'm going to want to jump the gun on buying anything. I'll probably want to wait longer than you want me to. I think you'll get into this more than you think you will. Nothing I could do but take his word for it and plan to focus on each step of this practice. If I'm going to learn to invest, I'm going to do it right, I decided. I didn't have years to mess around, and the potential to get to a life of freedom quicker than I ever believed possible was like a magnet drawing me in. We said our goodbyes and hung up. He had convinced me that abdication was not an option. I was going to do this myself. I felt an oddly layered mix of curious, anxious, and empowered. I was going to do this myself. I was going to do this myself. February practice. I didn't want to know my number, but finding it out did make me feel that reaching it might be possible. Make your own choice to know your number, and to have more control over it, play around with the different returns and other inputs to see all the different paths to financial freedom. To make finding your number easier, I put a Your Number calculator on my website, danielletown.com. Most important, practice consciously and regularly, acknowledging and being aware of your problems, and find a reason, however tiny, to be genuinely thankful for each of them. Chapter 3, Voting for a Mission with My Money. March. This month. Creating my investing office. Primer on corporations. Finding missions. Story of a company. My objections had been swatted away, and I had committed to this investing practice with my dad. All my excuses were still true. I was still busy, still bad at math, still overwhelmed by how much information there was to take in. How could I integrate learning to invest into my life so well that I would stick with it? I had to think practically now. When I feel overwhelmed, organizing has always been my saving grace. Organize my stuff and my mind feels equally less cluttered. The next cold Saturday at home, as my picture window sunrise view was being filled up by blue sky, I sat in my big chair and started to think about logistics. Where and when would I practice investing? In my yoga practice, I had my yoga mat to ground me. As long as I got on my yoga mat, even if only for 5 minutes, I considered my practice for that day done. Recently, I had gotten so desperate for time that my only yoga practice was when I would lock myself in the handicapped bathroom at work and try to imagine I was somewhere else while I breathed and touched my toes a few times. I avoided touching the floor like the plague, but in my mind, I was on my yoga mat, and at least it was something. At least I was trying. For runners, lacing up running shoes and leaving the house is often enough to get going. What was the equivalent of my yoga mat or my running shoes for investing? Investing was something I was doing on time borrowed from other items on my to-do list. If I didn't have an inviting environment that would spark the desire to spend time on my investing practice, I would probably let it peter out as the other items on my to-do list inevitably became more pressing. Indeed, I had no investing environment whatsoever. I didn't have a home office, nor did I even have room for one in my tiny apartment. Marie Kondo, the expert on tidying up, says to visualize in concrete terms the ideal space. I snuggled into my big chair and stared out the window at the stately university campus across town, as I often did, and thought about what would spark the fire of my practice. It would have some reminders of why I was investing. It would have some useful investing props. And it would have space for me to pile up papers and other investing debris. I set about creating my investing space. The magic of creating investing space. Buffett acolyte Guy Spier wrote in his book, The Education of a Value Investor, that he has a treasured photo of himself and Warren Buffett in his office to remind him who his hero is, uses a standing desk to stay alert, and stays away from analyses about companies as much as possible to keep his own counsel unsullied. My dad, on the other hand, mostly sits at his desk computer and regularly reads analyses as a counterpoint to his own viewpoint. He has some photos around him, but they're all positioned behind his back, so he doesn't actually look at them often. To each our own. Every corner in my tiny box of an apartment was spoken for. Marie Kondo was right, though. Visualizing did put what was most important to me into my mind. I always gravitate towards working in the dining room or kitchen, where there's some energy and some room to spread out and some snacks. Snacks are very important to completing good work. I decided my actual investing practice was going to have to be done at my dining room table. However, that meant my investing stuff would have to be cleared off and tucked away often. So I would fill a box with investing paraphernalia to serve as a kind of mobile office. Where my investing box was, my investing office was. I put a few talismans in a box to remind me which way to point my intentions and my brain, along with a few practical items any office needs. First, my talisman to remind me to be thankful for my problems, Maro. I had heart problems years ago that were difficult to diagnose. And my doctor gave me a heart-shaped stone after it was all over to remind me that things do get better. Second, something to remind me why I was doing this when I got tired and didn't feel like focusing on investing anymore. My North Stars, so to speak, to remind me of the tradition of value investors from whom I was learning. My dad's presence was already everywhere when I sat down to do investing practice, on the phone, in my email, in my head. Plus, on the bookshelf next to my dining table, I already displayed in the place of honor first editions of his two books with his handwritten inscriptions to me. Dad was there. Books were a good idea, though. I piled up other books to serve as a laptop stand, additional copies of Rule Number 1, Payback Time, and The Education of a Value Investor, Yvonne Chouinard's Let My People Go Surfing, Gretchen Rubin's The Happiness Project, and Atul Gawande's Complications, I put the life-changing magic of tidying up on the stack of books to remind me to be tidy and efficiently ruthless in the organization of my finances, and The Big Short to remind me that I had to look deeper than surface level and think about macroeconomic forces in the market, and that things can go very wrong when they look like they're going very right. Speer keeps photos of his father, one of his first investors, in his office to remind him who he's working for. Not that they necessarily need me, but being able to take care of my mom and my sister is a big part of how I envision financial freedom. So I picked a photo of us off the shelf and put it next to my computer. It was okay, but not quite right. I already had photos of my family all over my tiny house. I propped up a photo of myself, Kamala, and two other close friends from a night out in New York, and being inspired by them felt right. I also grabbed a photo that my friend took of me hiking in some amazing mountain scenery and gave to me as a gift because it made me feel expansive and reminded me that my idea of financial freedom meant having days available to go to the mountains or to the ocean or to a city or to do whatever I chose. I loved these photos and wanted to see them, and the only way I would see them was to pull them out of the box and set up my investing office. A small incentive, but a nice one. What else? I thought of something to entice me to open that box and create an inviting atmosphere. I put a scented travel candle in the box for some good smells when I sat down to practice, and a lighter so I wouldn't have to search for one each time. I considered putting headphones in the box so they would be easily available, but I only had one pair of quality headphones and I wanted to use them for non-investing time too. I decided I could easily grab them from their usual spot in the entryway keyhole and left them out of the box. Finally, and I wasn't sure why, but I grabbed a small prayer wheel that I bought at some touristy stall in Kathmandu a few years before. It was slightly off-kilter and nothing fancy, but I felt things about this prayer wheel. In Tibetan Buddhism, turning a prayer wheel while praying sends the energy of your prayer into the universe. I put it on the shelf next to my dad's signed books and turned the wheel. It sent my wishes, my prayers, my hopes for my investing practice into the universe. It also reminded me, by its presence, that wishing for something won't make it happen on its own. I have to turn the wheel. I have to practice investing. So that was my office, contained in an ugly plastic storage bin stowed on my bookshelf, all classy-like. A pile of books, a candle, talismans, photos, and a computer on my dining table. Not exactly Guy Speer's perfectly curated library. Oh well, I reminded myself not to let the perfect be the enemy of the good. Doing something to set up my space, even these small things, made me feel more in control. I felt like I was running headlong into that dense fog swirling around, but for goodness sake, at least my stuff would be organized. Then I prepared my computer. I made a folder titled Investing Practice and placed it prominently on my desktop. I already used a note-taking app to keep and organize news clippings, so I made a new notebook also titled Investing Practice. I wasn't sure what would go in each of these folders, but at least I was prepared. I wanted to set it up so that 2 or 8 or 10 years from now, when I wanted to know everything I had found on a company, I would be able to easily find it and I wouldn't have to duplicate my work. Now that I was set up, I could think about what I was actually going to invest in. The corporate form, I knew. It was the basis of all stocks and public markets, and understanding where it came from was key to understanding how it worked today. Executives get paid millions of dollars for screwing up their companies because of the evolution of corporations and liability, and I wanted to make sure I knew the underpinnings of the system to which I was going to subject my money. Corporations, a short history of illegal fiction. Corporations provide our products, transportation, food, shelter. Of course they do. Corporations and stock markets are just people. And we the people have invented these constructs, we lawyers like to call them legal fictions, so that we can invest in them without being personally on the hook for what they do. Their history led to me standing in my apartment that day, reviewing my investing office, thinking about how I would protect myself from subjecting my money to an unscrupulous corporate management team. Corporations have existed for thousands of years, but several hundred years after the Dutch invented the stock exchange, the British added their own history-changing innovation, limited liability for the owners of corporations, which is exactly what it sounds like. Liability of company owners was limited to the assets of the company, and their personal assets could not be reached by company creditors. It spurred entrepreneurship like nothing else, because once limited liability was enacted, no one worried about their families being ruined forever by the failure of a company. Limited liability, while fantastic for entrepreneurship, would turn out to be a double-edged sword for corporations and investors. The British economist Adam Smith's fundamental premise, that people will always act rationally in their own best interest, is modified substantially when the penalty for unconscionable behavior is muted by a corporate shield. The United States gradually adopted the view that even with the occasional corporate excesses, the benefits of corporations outweighed their drawbacks. The evolution of the corporate entity permits both angels and monsters. One corporation brings the comforts of kings to the middle class, while another destroys communities. Another corporation makes poor people rich, and another makes rich people poor. I knew that if I was going to be an investor, I wanted to be a values-driven, mission-oriented investor who could distinguish between the angel companies and the monster companies. Which businesses are behaving honorably, following the values I believe are important? I wanted to know which are not. Addressing the asymmetry. From my corporate legal work, I was constantly aware of the inherent asymmetry of information between public companies and their shareholders. If I were going to invest in my field of professional expertise, an early-stage startup, I would first get to know the founders personally to decide if they were worth betting on. Similarly, large investors in companies traded on the stock market do the same. They often meet with the executives, visit the company's offices and manufacturing facilities, and have experts who review the financials. Little guy investors, like me, don't get to do any of that. One thing that scared me about investing in public companies was that shareholders have less information than company management, and as such, are at an inherent disadvantage. The information the company has and the information the shareholder has is never going to be exactly the same. Shareholders are the owners of a company, but shareholders do not run a company. A fact about corporate structure that, as a lawyer, I find fascinating, but as a potential investor, I find daunting. Limited liability has given me, as a potential owner, the option to invest, but also to essentially check out of governance. There's that double-edged sword again. Instead, shareholders vote to elect the people who sit on the company's board of directors, which makes major decisions for the company. The board of directors then hires and appoints the company's executive officers, who run the operations of the company. The board of directors has a fiduciary duty, a legal and ethical responsibility, to make decisions for the company for the benefit of the shareholders, but with great latitude in how it accomplishes that purpose. In this way, in theory, shareholders indirectly control the company. And if a director is doing a poor job, shareholders can elect someone else to that director seat, or use other methods of recourse if there are egregious violations of that director's fiduciary duty. In practice, and depending on the company, many board members are eager to get something like $250,000 per year for a few hours of meetings, so they avoid rocking the boat and often rubber stamp the CEO's decisions. Consider executive pay, for example. The board is incentivized to hire executive officers who will grow the company and make the stock price rise, and the officers are incentivized to make the board happy with their performance and to, usually, make the stock price rise. Shareholders like a higher stock price, but this incentive structure sometimes perversely encourages short-term corporate decisions instead of longer-term growth. Is it any wonder that executive officer compensation at some companies has become higher and higher and higher? The incredibly high compensation has created mercenary CEOs who, even if the long-term results of their decisions harm the business, still get their millions in annual compensation and a golden parachute at the end. In 2015, the CEO of the oil drilling company Schlumberger was paid total compensation of $18.3 million, including a 12% raise in the cash he took home. The same year, the company cut 25,000 jobs, or 20% of its workforce, because it lost 27% of its revenue and 41% of its profit from the year before. Enron, WorldCom, Tyco, and HealthSouth top the list of companies that have been run by CEOs to make themselves rich, or even just to make themselves look good. Unfortunately, there are many examples of this kind of morally corrupt disparity between CEO pay and company performance, as well as employees' pay, and it has only gotten worse over the years. 50 years ago, CEO pay at major corporations averaged 20 times that of their employees. Today, CEO pay averages 300 times that of their employees. It's a stock market driven up by the short-term thinking of mercenary CEOs. Many companies participate in it, but some don't. As an investor, I wanted to support the ones that don't. Voting for a mission with my money. As I thought more about corporate practices, I decided to look for the few companies I could find that I really love. Corporations that are wonderful, in the sense that they share my values and they walk my talk. I wanted to support the Andrew Carnegies, Steve Jobses, and Oprah Winfreys of the world. They were not driven only by greed. They weren't perfect. They were driven by the personal desire to be the best, to create the best product, to invest their lives in making the best thing they could. It's not idealistic to say so. How was I going to figure out who the good guys were? I used to think the alluringly underachieving Lloyd Dobler in Say Anything was exactly right when I was wary enough to avoid investing in any business. I don't want to sell anything, buy anything, or process anything as a career. I don't want to sell anything bought or processed, or buy anything sold or processed, or process anything sold, bought, or processed, or repair anything sold, bought, or processed. You know, as a career, I don't want to do that. Fair enough, Lloyd. You boombox playing, tall, cool drink of water. But that wasn't me anymore. A few months ago, yes, but not now. What I wanted to do now was invest in people who were into everything Lloyd was not. People who were selling quality goods, who were buying things they'd carefully chosen, who were behaving with integrity. Some of my friends think we live in a dystopian world of corporate fascism, driven by the greed of faceless men. That might be true, if we do nothing. But I could cast a vote for which corporations and CEOs would occupy my world in the future. I suddenly realized I could vote with my dollars in a larger way. Every day, we, you and I, act on our morals with our money. We choose to buy organic food, sweatshop-free clothing, or American-made cars. But we have the opportunity to vote with our dollars in a much bigger, more impactful way than just buying dolphin-free tuna at the grocery store. We can support the mission of a right-acting company by buying its stock. By voting with all of our dollars, we could fix this stock market mess. As a consumer, I had voted with my dollars every single day for what I wanted to see more of in the market. I wouldn't buy conventional produce grown with herbicide, expecting that my choice would increase the amount of organic produce next year. If I bought organic, it encouraged more organic. And indeed, the organic grocery market has gone from non-existent to changing the face of the grocery industry in the last 30 years. Thanks largely to consumers voting with their dollars at Whole Foods, which forced conventional grocery stores to offer more natural and organic foods in order to compete. In exactly the same way, I now could expand voting with my dollars to the stock market. Rather than being limited by my physical proximity and my immediate consumer needs, my dollars could support companies that consider all of their stakeholders when they make major decisions run by leaders with integrity. If I had to invest, I wanted to invest in companies that understood that the bottom line, net profit, is required for their existence, but that it is not the only reason for existing. I wanted to vote for companies that had a mission to change the world for the better, just as much as the founders of the startups I loved did. The more I thought about it, the more I felt that these companies, with a strong mission I supported, would be better custodians of my money than anyone else. I did not want to support a company that took advantage of good people looking for honest work by paying its employees the bare minimum and treating them poorly, like Walmart does. A company can do extremely well financially without treating its employees well, as Walmart has, but I don't think it has great long-term prospects. There is a slow, decaying process to a company with a lot of employees who are unhappy. Aside from the ethics of how they're treated, those employees are definitely not going to give the extra hour needed to make something perfect. They're not going to provide excellent service to customers, and they probably won't stay at that company if they can find a viable alternative job. Similarly, I didn't want to own a company that buys chickens raised crammed into tiny cages and filled with antibiotics, like McDonald's. It matters to me to not shop in those stores and not buy that food when I can help it. In the same way that I wouldn't shop at companies that I didn't agree with, I wouldn't invest in them either. Investing might actually be useful in this world, I realized. Good companies need me, and others like me, to vote for them with our dollars for ethical animal farming, organic strawberries, and well-paid workers. I can buy Whole Foods stock regardless of how close the nearest Whole Foods is. I can buy Lululemon stock whether or not I buy any clothes from them this year. Ha! I can buy the public company that owns Jack Daniels, Brown-Forman, to support my bourbon obsession, even when I'm trying to be a good teetotaler. I get to vote with my money. The vote exists whether I'm conscious of it or not, and it definitely exists whether I want it to or not. I could ignore that fact, as most investors do, or I could embrace it. I'm not the only one who could vote with my money. Of the $70 trillion in the world stock markets, 85% of it is our money, remember? Most of the Wall Street professionals and robo-advisors out there don't consider investing to be a vote. And they don't consider mission at all. Their focus is solely on the bottom line. Those that do try to invest in right-acting companies almost always do so at the expense of making a good return. If we combine mission with a growing, well-managed, income-generating company, the impact would be incredible. I would do well for future Danielle by generating income to bring me to financial freedom, and I would join the rest of us 85% to support and invest in companies that deserve my hard-earned money. Companies that are consciously capitalist, in which doing good actively supports and enhances the bottom line. It has happened already. Investors took their money out of companies and organizations that supported or benefited from apartheid, and apartheid died. Investors took their money out of cigarette companies, and they have been severely weakened. Investors put their money into organic and natural foods companies, and now, even conventional grocery stores not only offer natural and organic products, they position them right up front where they're easy to find. Money talks. The largest investors in America aren't Warren Buffett and Bill Gates. They are retirement funds like CalSTRS, the California State Teachers Retirement System Pension Fund, with over $110 billion invested in the stock market. That $110 billion is all school teacher retirement money, little guy money. If all of us small investors took our money away from the control of Wall Street pension funds like CalSTRS, and invested it individually in what we want to support in the world. Those companies without good missions would either change or die. The long-awaited ethics revolution in corporate America would happen quickly, because the stock price follows the money. Take the money out of that stock, the stock price goes down, the CEO gets fired, and the board gets replaced. We're talking months, not years. That thought gave me a little shiver. It could be the end of overpaid CEOs and crony boards, the end of exploited workers, the end of polluters. It could be the growth of companies that use American workers and pay them well, that make products in America, that make sound environmental choices, that consider their stakeholders when making major decisions. It could be a market takeover of well-run, ethically managed, mission-oriented companies that make excellent returns for their investors. If we all acted like we are adults who take responsibility for our financial decisions, we would have massive power. It would also make this investing thing a lot more fun. We don't have a way of controlling institutional fund managers. All we can do is take our money away from them and do it ourselves. I started to feel a bit like an entrepreneur of my own investing portfolio. Where would I pivot next? What would I do to change the world next? Massively impressed with my own do-gooderness and surprised by how excited I was to vote for a mission with my money in the stock market, I noticed that I didn't feel quite as afraid of investing anymore. I jotted down the threads between all the companies I liked and called it my list of missions. My list of missions. Treat employees decently and pay a living wage. A company that isn't ethical is not putting good vibes out into the world. It's creating employees who don't like it. It'll eventually go down. Treat products decently. If animals, humanely. If products, be environmentally friendly. If food, use sustainable farming practices. Prefer local and small. Support the community and use local information about the company's environment, local reputation, and employees. I also noticed what was not on my list of missions. There was nothing on there about specific industries or products. Some people who are against firearms, for example, might never buy Smith & Wesson as a matter of principle. I didn't have any hard and fast positions like that, but others certainly do, and they should be voting their values with the same enthusiasm I was going to vote mine. Some might say that my investing dollars were so minimal that they would not have the slightest impact on any company I bought. It's the same argument as, I don't vote because one vote doesn't make any difference, or I just buy the cheapest, closest, easiest thing because it doesn't matter anyway. But one vote or purchase, multiplied by thousands of similar votes or purchases, could have a huge impact. More important, I knew I would be doing everything I could to put my own conscience at rest. I believe karma exists, and I wanted mine to be good. I stood there in my newly minted investing office, and I felt truly eager about this endeavor for the first time. Consciously capitalist companies, I realized, matter to me. I thought about buying a share of a company with a great mission, like Whole Foods. When I had thought of buying stock at lunch with my dad 2 months ago, I felt the enclosed concrete stairwell closing in. Strangely, now, I felt like a warrior. I now saw myself as a mission-oriented impact investor, asking which businesses are behaving honorably, following the values I believe are important, and which are not. I thought Dad would like my idea of voting for companies with missions, but I wasn't sure how he would react to my adding my own ideas to his methods. I knew he wanted to teach me exactly how he invested and would push me towards his answers. When I was a kid, he used to quiz me on long car rides about matters of philosophy and religion using the Socratic method. Socrates, like my dad, infuriatingly asked leading questions to guide his subject towards the answer he wanted. No wonder the Athenians killed him. Dad and I had another investing practice call towards the end of the month. We weren't exactly hitting our weekly call plan even a few weeks in, but we were both trying hard to make time for them, which was good enough for me. I blurted it out. Dad, I have to invest in companies with values that I want to support with my money. Otherwise, I'm going to feel bad about what I'm supporting, and that's eventually going to make me lose interest and not want to do it anymore. Good! Vote for your values. I love it. The mission of the business and their values are part of what I call the story of a company. I had no idea what he was talking about. Like, its history? The story of a company. As I do my research into a company, he went on, I naturally concoct in my head a tale of how that company came to be, who runs it, and why it does what it does. I call this tale a story. I follow a kind of simple outline to create a story about a business, meaning, management, moat, margin of safety. I know we haven't gone into them yet, but we will, in depth. Another very important part of the story about a business should be that its values are what you want to see more of in the world. Mission. Research into a company, he explained, can quickly broaden in scope. You start with Apple and end up studying superconductors in Chinese plants. Keeping the story in mind, Dad said, keeps him focused on the most important issues for determining if this was a good investment. Do you write the story down or say it out loud? Dad thought about it. I guess I've been doing it for so long, I don't take the time for a formal statement. I kind of do it in my head, and then I usually talk it out to a few people I trust. Well, I knew right then I would do things a little differently, though I didn't tell him that. I had a method of making an argument honed by years of law school and practicing, and I knew I needed to see an argument written in black and white. I write it. Writing it down forces me to be precise. The choice of words matters. It's not casual. He laid out his story system for me. It starts with how he found the business and if other investors are buying it. Then comes understanding the business, in particular, what protects it against competition, who runs it, and what is its value. He then describes the industry, its competition, and why this business has a durable competitive advantage backed up with compelling historical consistency of performance and a solid management team. The story goes on to state the value of the business, the price at which he would buy the business, the buy price, and what event put this business on sale, along with how long it might take the business to recover. Finally, he summarizes with three great reasons to buy the company. You're going to explain all this stuff to me, right? He laughed. Of course, that's the rest of the year. I thought about how I would evaluate a startup company as an investor. What is this company all about right now? And what is their plan for the future? That's pretty much what I wanted to make sure I knew. As a lawyer for emerging companies, I had quite a lot of experience in looking for issues that could derail an investment. Attorneys invert stories for a living. I like that you call it a story. It reminds me that it's my perspective on that company. My story of Apple might be different from your story of Apple. Absolutely, especially when you add your values, what you're calling the company's mission. Describe its mission and values and why you really love it and want to see it prosper in the world. I love that you do that. Your missions are different from mine. So our perspectives on a certain company's value in the world is probably going to be different. That was so sweet. I felt gratified that my dad appreciated my contribution to my own investing practice, but also to his investing practice. It felt a bit like we were walking this path of learning together, instead of him always leading me. He seemed to be listening to me and taking in what I had to say. He had done that before when he asked me questions of law, for example, but now we were on his turf, and he seemed okay with a few changes to the landscaping. It made me trust him a little more in this practice. Really? You don't mind my adding something to your investing method? Not at all, he assured me. In fact, it tells me you're a natural at this. You'll only invest in a few companies over your entire life anyway, so they should be companies you absolutely love. Buffett only invests in companies he loves, but the companies he loves are probably different from the companies you love. At a recent annual meeting, Buffett was asked why he still invests in Coca-Cola. Doesn't he see that all that sugar is bad? Buffett said that he drinks 6 Cokes a day, and it makes him happy. Then he added that he's been to Whole Foods and that nobody's smiling at Whole Foods. What? I choked in mock shock. He was joking, but not about his values. He puts his money where his mouth is. Of course the master had already thought of voting for a mission with his money. So much for my stroke of genius. And his missions were different from mine, because of course they were. We're different, and that's the point. I'd vote for my values, he'd vote for his, and we'd see what happened. But at least we didn't pretend our money was voting for nothing. I remembered the fourth level of mastery, the level we all aspire to. Unconscious competence. I imagine it as the birds singing, the fog lifting, and a spotlight from heaven shining upon me. That was my goal. I wanted to learn from someone on that level. It sounded like that was where Buffett was. We had long planned a family trip back home to Jackson Hole, Wyoming, and I showed up inundated with work, remotely plugged into the office the whole time. Still, it was too good of an opportunity for Dad and me to be together and talk investing and do a different sort of work. First, I wanted to know the underpinnings of this value investing shenanigan that Warren Buffett and my dad liked so much. And I knew others would want to learn too. As we sat in the living room together, I mentioned, I think we should start a podcast about this. I'm not the only one in my situation needing freedom. I know lots of people who would benefit from learning this investing practice along with me. Oh yeah? Dad said. What's a podcast? Something you couldn't get for a nickel when you were a boy. Old people. I showed him on my phone. He immediately understood that it would be a great way to reach people who, like me, avoid the financial industrial complex. Invested, the rule number one podcast, was born. I hoped having to talk regularly with my dad about investing would keep me on track in my practice, and I knew it would help others do the same. Much like the law, investing has a language unto itself, and it's not taught in school. We normals needed this help. When I started my first year of law school, I felt like I was trying to drink from a fire hose. Decisions were written using words I had never read before, so I spent a lot of time with Black's Law Dictionary next to me and four colored highlighter pens to color the different parts of the case. Our criminal law professor told our class that law is a language, and you have to learn the language before you can function smoothly in it. It took me about 6 months of law school before I had a moment when I realized I had just read a case without consciously struggling with the format or the vocabulary. I had learned the language. I was having a strange sense of deja vu to those first days in law school as I thought about understanding a company in which I might potentially invest. All these words my dad used effortlessly. Compounding, returns, inflation for God's sake, were part of a foreign language, and they implied that other words would have to be used, and then more new vocabulary learned on top of that. I knew it was only going to get worse. But, like any foreign language, all I had to do was put some effort into learning the language. Or so I told myself. Buffett is the best, right? I asked my dad. He's the best. We're not starting with him, though. We're not? We're going to start with his business partner, Charlie Munger. If any investor is as smart as Warren Buffett, it's Charlie. Munger laid out the basics of their investing strategy in four simple principles in an interview he gave to the BBC. Everything I do in investing, and everything Munger and Buffett do, is derived from these four principles. March practice. Spend 10 minutes creating your investing office. What will create your own atmosphere of financial freedom? What will support you to keep going when your practice is difficult? Then, in your investing office, brainstorm how you already vote with your money. What are the values you're supporting? Do you want to keep supporting them? From that, make a list of the missions you choose to vote for with your investing money. Chapter 4. The First Principle of Value Investing. April. This month. Events. Understanding the business. Circle of Competence and the Three Circles Exercise. Gurus. Investing Intensive. First, Dad started, we've got to back up so that you have the context in which to understand a given company. Let's talk about the market and why it works the way it does. Efficient Market Hypothesis, EMH. Let's assume people are rational, Dad began. A reasonably rational fund manager wouldn't sell a stock worth $100 for $50, and wouldn't buy a stock worth $50 for $100. I wouldn't, you wouldn't, and none of the thousands of smart fund managers would either. Well, I agree with that, I nodded. There was even a theory that explained it, Efficient Market Hypothesis, EMH. EMH says that if people are rational actors who buy and sell based on what a stock is worth, then a stock's price is completely rational and, here's the key, fully reflects all available information at any given moment in time. All of the possibilities of a stock going up or down are immediately factored into the price by thousands of smart people who have all the information and are bidding on the stock all at the same time. The theory says that the pricing of stock based on information available at every given moment makes the market efficient. Therefore, The price of the stock at any given moment is exactly the same as its underlying value. If, in an efficient market, information is priced into the stock almost instantaneously, that explains why hardly any professionals can beat the market, Dad summarized EMH. The moment there's new information, the bidders will adjust based on that information and the stock will immediately reset to a price that reflects its new value. I remember discovering that almost no mutual funds beat the market more than a few years in a row. My dad told me that EMH perfectly explains why. Any attempt to outsmart the market by picking good companies would be futile because every good and every bad company is already priced to where it's a 50% probability that the stock price will go up and a 50% probability that the stock price will go down. Well, But there is a counterexample to EMH. $10,000 put into the first Buffett partnership in 1956 would have grown to $2.5 million by 1973, while the same money in the stock market index would have only grown to $50,000. If EMH is true and nobody can beat the market, then how do you explain Buffett's success? One academic said Buffett was like a lottery or slot machine winner or a monkey flipping coins. Just lucky. Footnote. In 1973, Burton Malkiel, a professor at Princeton University, published A Random Walk Down Wall Street to explain EMH to the general public. And in the book, he raised the elephant in the EMH room, Buffett. Warren Buffett had been crushing the stock market for nearly 20 years at that point, and Malkiel dismissed it. If the odds are 50-50 on each coin toss, and a monkey tosses a billion coins, the monkey will get very close to exactly 50% heads and 50% tails. But if the monkey only tosses 100 coins, is it so hard to imagine that one very lucky monkey could get 100 heads in a row? There are always a few results way out on the tail of the bell curve. In other words, in a random stock market, we should be surprised if there wasn't at least one Warren Buffett. This all made so much good, solid sense that several Nobel Prizes in economics were awarded for the EMH work being done to show how rational and efficient the market is, and thus that the only way to beat the market was to get lucky, over and over again, for a long time, as Warren Buffett was thought to have done. Lucky monkeys. Warren Buffett, having essentially been called a lucky monkey, responded by saying nothing. For 9 more years, he let his investing returns do the talking. If Malkiel had invested only $1,000 with Buffett when his book came out in 1973, he would have had $2,378,280 by 2015. In 1984, Buffett let everyone know that, yeah, he was well aware that he caused the conversation, and boy, did he have that paper. He published an article in the Columbia Business School magazine titled The Super Investors of Graham and Doddsville, in which he argued against being a lucky monkey. He made the point that if you found lucky monkeys that all, quote, came from a particular zoo in Omaha, you would be pretty sure you were onto something. That is, if you found any really extraordinary concentrations of success, you might want to see if you could identify concentrations of unusual characteristics that might be causal factors, end quote. Buffett's zoo was founded by his teacher and mentor, Benjamin Graham, who pioneered what would become the basis for Buffett and Munger's investing strategy. The Benjamin Graham Zoo of Value Investing Strategy had produced quite a few monkeys who had gone out on their own, and Buffett cited the records of several other of these monkeys who all used Benjamin Graham's investing strategy of, quote, mentally always buying the business, not buying the stock, end quote, at a lower price than its value. He pointed out that their stock picks were all entirely independent, they had not discussed them with each other, and their overlap was extremely low. These records do not reflect one guy calling the flip and 50 people yelling out the same thing after him, he noted. Their results? The worst track record of the group crushed the stock market index. The best record, Rick Guerin's, even crushed Buffett's. Buffett concluded that there has to be inefficiency in the market for all these investors, all independently investing with the same method, to be able to exploit gaps between price and value. When the price of a stock, he declared, can be influenced by a herd on Wall Street with prices set at the margin by the most emotional person, or the greediest person, or the most depressed person, it is hard to argue that the market always prices rationally. In fact, market prices are frequently nonsensical. Remember those Dutch guys in the bar who created the first stock exchange? Buffett was talking about guys like those influencing each other, and the ensuing herd mentality that starts when they worry that they're going to be left behind. Buffett's point is that fund managers commonly buy and sell based on fear or greed, not on ruthlessly rational, fully informed decisions. Warren Buffett and Charlie Munger saw that emotion often drives decisions, and they exploited it. They bought when the herd was selling out of fear, and sold when the herd was buying out of greed. Clearly, by their track record of high annual returns, it worked. So, did economics professors take Buffett's point that emotions and inefficiency affected the stock market, and that the market was not as ruthlessly efficient as EMH claimed, and immediately stopped teaching EMH? Nope. They just ignored Buffett or declared him an exception and stuck with EMH. Then, in 1999, Robert Shiller, an economics professor from Yale, published his book Irrational Exuberance. The title is from a quote by then-chairman of the Federal Reserve, Alan Greenspan, who in 1997 said, "The stock market has become irrationally exuberant." He said that the supposedly rational and efficient market was manic, that the market was acting on emotional whims, not reason. Shiller proved that Greenspan was right, and the market regularly behaved irrationally. This was the first major shot fired into the EMH paradigm by a well-respected academic, and it was not the last. In 2013, Shiller received the Nobel Prize in Economics. Suddenly, people remembered that Buffett and Munger had been saying for years that the market moved nonsensically, and their formula was to buy when the market was full of fear and sell when it was full of greed. The next shot into the hull of EMH was The Black Swan, by Nassim Nicholas Taleb, a former options trader turned academic who tore into the 1997 Nobel Prize-winning EMH theories of Robert Merton, and argued that the market is not random, nor a bell curve, nor is it unbeatable. Black swan is a Taleb term that means events that were thought not to exist, like black swans were thought not to exist, until they were found in the wild. Taleb found that these supposedly rare events actually happen with regularity. Recent examples of black swan movements of the stock market are the rise of the internet, that was greed to get in on a high-growth industry, a bubble, the 2001 dot-com crash, that was fear of wildly overvalued tech stocks, a crash, and the 2008 real estate crash. That was major fear in response to the discovery of fraudulent financial instruments, almost depression-era fear. And now that the market has been in a nonstop upward trend for 10 straight years, greed is kicking in again. Two Israeli behavioral economist psychologists, Daniel Kahneman and Amos Tversky, added to the EMH attack by proving over the course of their 30-year academic careers that, contrary to Adam Smith's and EMH's hypothesis about human behavior, humans do not act rationally all the time. In fact, they showed that in conditions of high stress, uncertainty, and rapidly changing data, humans can usually be counted on to act on what they called fast thinking, thinking based on biases and emotion. Instantly running away when you think a lion is about to attack is fast thinking that can save your life. But this predisposition humans have in situations of high stress and uncertainty to leap to an action that worked in the past can result in wrong action in the present. In the stock market, it isn't always right to run from uncertainty. Considering that the stock market can be a high-stress, rapidly changing environment, their work suggests it is more likely than not that the market can be driven in an irrational direction by the mass of traders operating on unthinking biases, particularly when there is an unexpected event that creates fear. Kahneman got the Nobel Prize for his work in 2002. The torpedoes into the EMH boat are increasing. Richard Thaler, a behavioral economist from the University of Chicago,